Your Partner in Success Radio is a free business podcast with host Denise Griffiths. It's all about great stories, conversation, and context to help you move your business and life forward with actionable tips and advice from her guest experts. To listen and subscribe, just find us on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you consume your podcasts.
Good morning and welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio, where top performers share their secrets to help you achieve your personal and professional goals. I am your host, Denise Griffiths, and together with my amazing guests, we bring you inspiring and actionable insights that are aimed to take your life and your business to the next level. Ranked in the top 2% globally, this podcast is a must listen, and it's because of my guests. So whether you're tuning in for entrepreneurial tips, career advice, or personal development strategies, get ready to turn inspiration into action, challenges into triumphs, and dreams into reality. And this is the part where I always say, take notes, lots of notes. So my guest today, Erin Hatzacosta, is a fervent advocate for authenticity, and she sees it as a powerful tool for career growth, effective leadership, and creating thriving organizational cultures. And she is formerly a corporate CEO, and Erin seamlessly transitioned into the roles, a professional speaker, author, and coach. She champions authenticity in workplace dynamics and leadership through her company, Be Authentic. Let me try this again. Be Authentic, Inc., fostering genuine expression and transparency in professional settings. And notably, this is important, during her time at a Fortune 50 company, her ascent to the CEO of their $2 billion with a B subsidiary, Payflex, at just 42 years old was a significant achievement. I'd say so. Her innovative radical authenticity approach not only tripled earnings, but also markedly boosted employee engagement. And that is so important. And as the author of the best-selling book, I'm a little cranky today, so hang in there with me. I can't speak. I've got something going on in my throat. As the author of the best-selling book, You Do You-ish, and a sought-after TEDx speaker, her insights have resonated worldwide, and I have that book on my desk. So in essence, Erin draws upon her corporate experience to empower individuals and organizations to embrace authenticity fully, unlocking profound personal, this is important, listen, personal and professional success. Erin, good morning. Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio, and thank you for sending your book to me. I think I told you, in fact, I know I told you in the green room, you are now my spirit animal. I love this book. I spent time with it when it first landed on my doorstep. I always do. And then I read it over the weekend because I knew I was going to be chatting with you today. I laughed and I chuckled, and I don't mark up books. It's against my religion, but I've got sticky notes all over it. So I love your snark. Let me go there.
I know. And the fact that you said snark is so funny because my next book, I'm working with a publisher, and she's fantastic. Like, we totally jive. She's, you know, my biggest fear are always moving from self-publishing to a traditional publisher was that they were going to take some of my sass or my snark, you know, my authenticity out of there. You never know. And I did use the word snarky once or twice in the next book. And that was one of the things she's like, or maybe it was in the description. She's like, I think that's kind of a negative connotation. And you just affirmed, because I was like, I don't know, the circles I run in, they seem to like it. So I'm glad that you appreciate the snark, and I'm so glad to be your animal.
I didn't have another term for it. You laughed at me in the green room, and I don't blame you, but I didn't have another description.
I love it.
To me. But you've got some terrific quotes in here. I mean, it's just, let me find one that I just really, really loved. Authenticity is about exposing who you are when people least expect it. Now, how true is that?
Yeah. And I actually, that quote, I added a line since I've written the book, because I use this in my keynotes, because I redefine authenticity. I do not talk about it like the fluffy be yourself BS. Like, that I would be, that would be like a year tour, and then I would want to throw up all over myself. But the line I added, I like to say authenticity is about exposing who you are when people least expect it, in the service of others. And sounds, it sounds not very snarky. It sounds like super woo-woo, but it's so important because I think the thing that is one of the biggest ahas when I speak to audiences and get to sort of get that real-time interaction and reaction is that authenticity isn't, you know, first of all, it's not be yourself. It's not transparency. It's not the same thing. And but authenticity is not about you. And once you can grab and grasp that, especially, you know, my context, I mostly talk about it in the workplace, right? And in business, in your career, in your cultures, but also in your sales, et cetera. If you can start to switch your mind and say, wait, no, I'm going to be more authentic, not because it makes me feel better, but because it makes the other person feel better. It increases trust and connection. It's like a fast pass to connection and trust and gives them permission. Like I was saying to you, like you were all worried about your raspy voice. And I was like, oh, thank God. Thank God, because I feel so much better. I'm a podcast host too, right? And I'm like, oh my God, listen to this woman who just is so perfect at her, you know, introduction. And at the end of the day, we all just want authenticity. We want a little imperfection. But frankly, it makes us feel better about ourselves who are also imperfect. So I'm glad you like that quote and just wanted to add that on because to me, that's sort of a game changer as people think about authenticity.
It really is. And I was making notes while you were talking because, and I wrote down authenticity redefined. And basically what I was thinking to myself was that instead of just saying be yourself, which we hear so often, oh, just be yourself. No. You do not want me to be myself on my worst days. Just trust me on this. So
yeah, I actually call that being faux-thentic. And the definition is bringing your whole shitty self to work. So yeah.
Been there, done it. I'm doing it right now in my own office. Yeah. And I loved it. And I was going to ask how you describe the deeper meaning and power of authenticity and leadership, but I think you've already done that.
Yeah. And I'll tell you why too. You know, it's not just to be like, ooh, look at me. I've got a different definition, academic. What happened to me is, you know, and it's funny, you introduced me and the one thing I would correct, you said I seamlessly transitioned. I did not seamlessly transition. It was sort of a up and down, right? Like nobody does that, right? Into going from CEO to a speaker, author, consultant. And I say that because it took a lot of reflection. I actually wasn't going to do what I'm doing. This whole concept of, you know, being, at the time too, my perception was like, oh, I'm going to be HRE kind of consultant. And I was like, that is so not me. I'm a businesswoman. Like I like to do different things. I did not spend, no offense to HR professionals, but that's just not where I played. And what happened for me, the reason I got so actually I'm obsessed with authenticity is that when I had great success, first of all, I knew it wasn't because I worked harder. I'm not lazy, don't get me wrong, but I'm not that person who is like, I'll do whatever it takes. I'll sacrifice whatever. I mean, that's what we all fear as women. And I wasn't willing to do it, right? Like I'm going to give up vacations. I'm going to move my family. I'm going to work nights and weekends and have my nanny, you know, make dinner three nights a week. Like I just wasn't willing to do that. But then I had all this success. But what happened was I along the way, I was like, okay, when's my luck going to run out? Like when am I going to be found out? When's the secret? Like this shouldn't happen. Right. Because we're so taught that, as you rise, right, you have to compromise more and more. And I wasn't. And again, it wasn't that it was easy. Don't get me wrong. I had some tough stuff and I did some hard work, but when I decided to retire, cause I was itching, I thought I wanted to go run maybe a healthcare startup or something. I just had been 22 years in the sort of the same corporate parent company. And I was just itching, but everybody kept saying, we're going to miss your authentic leadership. And it didn't surprise me, but it sort of hit me and it took me a little bit. It was like, wait a minute, maybe I wasn't going to be found out. Maybe I was just playing a totally different game. And when I realized I was playing a totally different game, I started to diagnose that. And I realized that I wasn't just being myself. Like I didn't come into work like I'd come, you know, go to my friend's party. That it was more nuanced. It was more powerful. It was more strategic at the time, probably, you know, pretty subconsciously strategic. Now I sort of teach it a little bit more. And so that's what really put me on this like path to say, okay, what really is it? And then I found, and then I went to the Greeks, of course, because I married a Greek. I went to the Greek origin of the word, which is authentikos. And that was my first clue. I looked at it and I said, okay, authentikos means three things. It means to be genuine, but it also means to be original and authoritative. And I was like, I knew it. Like, I knew this, like, authenticity wasn't the same as me just walking into work being myself. And so I tell you all of that because I think it's really important not to just think, oh, we redefine it because we want to redefine it. It truly is a more powerful word. And it's funny when I speak to audiences and I, you know, I have this ridiculous bit I do. And obviously I have a lot of humor in it, a lot of snark. There's different components to it, but it's weird. The definition portion of that talk is most often the thing that people keep going back to that really unlocks them when they realize it's not just being their self, that it's not about them, that it, when they slow down and think about, well, yeah, what do I like when I go to a town hall? What town hall do I like? The one where it's sort of the same old and the PowerPoints and the earnings and the, or do I like the ones where they tell stories or the executive makes fun of themselves? And like, I like the other one. And so people just start to reflect and go, wait a minute, you're right. The thing that I like is the same thing that probably other people like about me. And if I can think about being authentic and kind of going against the norm, because the norm is not authenticity in the workplace, it's a lot easier to do that when I know it's not just something for me.
And listen, I agree with you. And I'm on page 29, and you say you found that the real power comes not simply when you're being authentic. The real power comes when you start doing authentic.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with you. And then this is where I put a sticky note. And this is on page 31, and I'm not going to read the whole thing, but you're talking about strategic authenticity. And I love this. Get ready to get selfish, my friend. It's the best thing you can do. And for others, let's talk about that a bit.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the reality is, even though I say, okay, authenticity isn't about you, it's about others. It's about letting your guard down, about exposing who you are. It's about telling stories and modeling and, you know, the sort of, I have a whole framework to get you starting to do it. And it's about the other person. And then you go, well, that's great. That's what I do every day. Do things for other people. The reality is, if you think of it that way, if you go into a meeting and you're more authentic so you can create that connection, if you work on your website and get rid of the BS words and use more sort of fun and plain language because you know it's better for the other person, the reality is it all comes back to you, right? Like, you're going to have better results. If you're in sales and you use authenticity and people trust you more quickly and connect, you're going to sell more stuff, right? If you're a leader and use authenticity because you think it's the right thing for your team, giving them that sort of permission and getting their, you're going to get their attention more. They're going to do more work for you. They're going to follow you. So I sort of reverse it. It's like, if you can first think about doing it for the other person, which gets you past that, you know, that what I describe, you know, in the workplace, as entrepreneurs and as corporate workplaces, there's sort of this inauthentic river that is easy to get caught up in. And you just, you know, you just get caught down it and you do the things like everybody else does. And you follow the formula and you follow the template and you run your meetings because you don't want to look wrong. You want to look right. And when you start to change that a little bit and say, okay, but what if I don't do what is right or accurate or the playbook, and I actually do authenticity for other people, trust me, you're going to start to stand out from the pack. You're going to start to sell more things. You're going to have people follow. You're going to get promoted. So it all comes back to you.
It does. And you're reminding me of an event. I was at a board meeting that I was dragged into willy-nilly. I didn't want to be part of it. I was just kind of dumped in the middle of all this thing. And this was probably over 20 years ago. It's still the most tedious day I've ever spent in my life. And everybody was doing exactly what you're talking about. Yeah, they were all so perfect. And I'm slumped in my seat because the more it went on, the more I slid. I was hoping I could get under the table and crawl out, but that didn't happen.
Yeah.
And there was this one woman sitting in there. I had no idea who she was because this was my first time in this room and I hadn't sorted out who was doing what. I just knew that I hated most of them instantly. Really did. And I still kind of do. It was a long time ago, but they didn't change. I did. But and I'm looking at this woman and she's sitting there completely impassive. I mean, she wasn't blinking. She wasn't, she never made a sound. And she kind of scared me. I was like, please, who is this woman? And finally, everybody, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 days later, it seemed like it ended. And I wandered to the kitchen. I wanted to get a cup of water and, you know, maybe a mallet to beat my head with. And this woman standing there, and I said something remarkably snarky, and I can't say it here, but it was remarkably snarky. She looked at me and she cracked up. We've been best friends all these years. She is my dearest friend in the world. She said, she said, if I'd known you, I would have warned you. As well, it's too late now. You want to be friends? And she said, yeah.
I love it. Well, that's the thing. Like, we all have this disease. Everybody sitting in that boardroom has this disease that is basically they think they're the only ones that are miserable. They're the only ones that are craving it, and everybody else doesn't. And it's like, nope. Actually, you know, the way I describe it, it's like when you go to those birthday parties with your kids when they're like 4, and at the end of the party, they serve, you know, they serve the kids the cake, the pizza, and then they bring on the cake. And the kids all take their pieces and ask for more ice cream and whatever. And then they have the extra and they bring it around to the awkward sort of semicircle of adults waiting to get the hell out of there. And, you know, they walk around and they ask everyone, you know, would you like a piece of cake? Now, what do most people say?
Oh, sure. Of course. Mm-hmm. Actually, I think they say no, thank you. They want to be greedy.
Yeah, no, because they think, oh, and then, you know, what are most people thinking? Like, they really would love a piece of that cake. And that's authenticity in the workplace. Everybody thinks they're the only ones craving the cake. And the reality is everybody wants it.
And see, I would not, but I don't like sugar.
No. Oh, well, we're no longer spirit animals.
Oh, I'm sorry. I love sugar. I'm going to miss you. I just don't like it. I can't stand, went the whole body just thinking about it. But I didn't even think about that. But yeah, people are just kind of, you know, showing up the way they think they're supposed to show up and kind of prolonging the misery, aren't they?
Yep. Yes, ma'am.
Interesting. So can you make a case for why operating with more authenticity is good for the bottom line and overall success? What's the ROI?
Yeah. So we got really curious on that about 3 years ago and did a research study to put some numbers right behind what I often call fluffy unicorn doo-doo that people think is authenticity. And what we found—
See, that's not snark. That's factual.
That's factual. That's a fact. As my kids would say, facts. And what we found is sort of what we expected, but at a magnitude way higher than we expected. And actually with a couple of the results were quite unexpected. But, you know, what we found is that organizations that have higher authentic cultures and leaders have 6 times the trust. So 600% increase in trust. And the way I like to give people tough love is like, look, if you're an authentic manager, your people maybe trust you on a Thursday. But if you're an authentic manager, they're trust you on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And then the best part is they're not even thinking about you on Sunday. And so we know that it skyrockets trust. And then we can link that. I mean, we had other results too, but if you want to link it right to profitability, we know from a Harvard business case study, the neuroscience of trust shows that companies with higher trust have much higher employee engagement, which duh, right? People care, give a shit about their job if they trust the environment they're in. And then we know from a Gallup study that's published almost every year in different ways that companies with higher employee engagement have 21% higher profits. So what it really comes down to is the higher trust and connection. And what's interesting, well, this is not interesting probably for anybody else but me. This is really stupid. But when I first started talking about this, and you kind of alluded to it in your intro, you know, the focus for me was really on culture, leadership, and then also personal career success. I mean, that's sort of the subtitle of the book, right? Get the career you deserve. And I don't know why I'm this stupid, but, you know, I was about 3 years in and I had this large, you know, Fortune 250 company's sales team want to hire me to do some training. And I had done a little bit with sales before, but most of the cuts were leadership, executives, women's groups. And I realized, I'm like, you dumbass, like this is, authenticity is helpful internally, of course, for all of those things. But from a sales perspective, the entire business, especially if you're selling B2B large deals, is all about connection and trust, right? And differentiation. And that's exactly what it does. So I've started to draw even closer line of sight. I do a lot more work these days with sales organizations because, especially in the B2B world, especially in insurance, healthcare, financial services, I mean, talk about a world that is still just operating down that inauthentic river, right? There's just like all kinds of buzzwords and 84-page PowerPoints at finalist meetings. And, you know, and so and then they're frustrated why they're not winning, why they're not differentiating, why it takes 12 meetings to get somebody to buy from you. And what I realized is what I teach around authenticity is actually a speed pass to that. It's a way to differentiate yourself. It's a way to get the sale quicker, to create that trust and connection. So that's really where I've seen the direct link. And I have companies now that are working with me on a regular basis because they saw such immediate impact from their sales teams and their ability to close, especially those big B2B deals, when they added, you know, strategic authenticity.
My friend Ben Gay III, he wrote the Sales Bibles, The Closers, and he's my Wednesday podcast co-host. And many, many years ago, he was the final mentee of Dr. Napoleon Hill. He's got wisdom under his belt a lot. Mm. And he coined the phrase many, many years ago, which has been taken on by hundreds of people. So he's had to add to it a bit. But people will buy from people they know, like, and trust.
Yeah.
And now he says in something along the lines and who they feel comfortable with. But you have to, I don't know about you. Well, I do know about you because you're my spirit animal. If I don't like you, I'm not going to trust you. I don't care what you say. If I've got that instant, I've got the ickies, there's very little you can do to get me back on your side of the table.
Yeah. And what happens is people can, you can gain that trust if you spend enough time. But in this sort of modern world, let's call it, maybe post-COVID, probably happening even before that, your ability to get extra time with your prospects is so low. Like the days of, you know, being able to get them out on a golf course for, you know, 18 plus the 19th hole drink, or to even a steak dinner when you're in town is so much harder, right? Because people are, they've got more work than they know what to do with. They've gotten sort of used to like, well, why would we do that? We can just do a quick Zoom. You've got more women in leadership. I'm sorry, but women, we ain't got time for that stuff. And so I would call this sort of more modern world where their attention span is low. You're mostly doing it through, you know, virtual meetings or RFPs or emails. You need something to speed past that. Otherwise you're going to go insane. And if you can just start to use words that are a little less polished and, you know, the bar is so low because your competitors are acting like the people in that boardroom that you went to, right? Denise, right? Like that's what they're doing. So it's like, it doesn't take much. And I say this all the time. I'm like, the bar is low, people, in your industry. I've talked to industries mostly where the bar is low. And what I mean by that is there is not a lot of differentiation, SaaS, authenticity, boldness, right? It's all just like, how do I sound perfect? And how do, you know, we put the patient at the center of everything we do, and, you know, big buzzwords about their strategy. And it's like, yeah, so does everybody else. So if you can just start to splash in and have a little bit of humility and think about, okay, what would I want to see? Or how do I speed pass? Well, maybe being perfect will make them trust me quicker. Like, you've got the advantage. So that's what I love about this. It's like, not everybody works with me, right? Not everybody buys into it. But when they do, I'm like, you're so smart, because this is like the cheapest, funnest, easiest way to stand out from the pack and make sales quicker and make leaders better and do, you know, do both of them at the same time. So I love it when I can find, you know, that company, those right partners who get that maybe they've been doing it accidentally. And if they just turn on the burners a little bit more, like it's just going to be easy to win.
This is a little bit off track, but you made me think of it. I'm writing a book for the closers, and it is about sales, but it's also about podcasting and get your voice heard. And it occurred to me, because I'm having to dig very deep into how I operate now, because mm-hmm. you know it, and then you find out, oh, I didn't know that about myself. How interesting. What else am I missing? But I realized that I speak very differently than I write. And I'm finding that out because mm-hmm. you know, words when I write. And I said, why do I do this? It occurred to me that I learned to read. I taught myself to read when I was about 3 years old. Nobody told me I couldn't read, so I read. And I was reading anything and everything that my parents had on their bookshelves, including, you know, Guy de Maupassant and, you know, some of the French. They were in English, but I mean, I was reading enormous words, but spelling them phonetically. And I found out, to my deep chagrin recently, as I'm writing some of my chapters, that there are words that I can spell them. I know the origin of them, but I don't dare say them because I've never heard them pronounced.
Yeah. And, you know,
when
you can, not just as an author, but even people that are listening and they write emails, they write their LinkedIn profile, they write copy for their website, right? When you can finally realize that writing is just speaking on paper. That's what people want. They want, you know,
simple, stupid.
Yep. Just speak on paper. Mm-hmm. And that's for my book. When I wrote my first one, at some point along the process, I was like, cause I, in my head, I was like, I am not supposed to be an author. I was a math major in college. Like I haven't written more than a 5-page paper, cause I went through, you know, the business and math college. But I'm like, wait, I talk a lot. And what if I just talk on paper? And so I love that you bring that up, because I think beyond just authors, like one of the things that I would encourage you to do is talk on paper. Don't go to a meeting in person and have like a great connection and laugh and probably be more authentic and share something, or maybe you go to a conference, right? And you share a drink and then turn around and write a flippant email that sounds like a robot. It makes me so angry. Like, just write back like you're talking to that person. You know, quit trying to, you know, pass the test.
And that is such a great point, because I think we all do it. I'll catch myself doing it. So, well, I'm smarter than this. I can, oh, Denise, give it a rest. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You might be the smartest person in the room, and I can say that with all sincerity because I live alone. But I don't need to constantly shove my intellect or my EQ or IQ down people's throats.
Yeah, it's funny. I just did a post on LinkedIn that I wrote, you know, sort of a quote that I wrote, you know, people do business with people who are smart, who sound smart. And then I crossed out smart and I wrote inhuman. And that's the truth. Right. People do not do business with people who sound smart. They do business with people who sound human.
And thank you for sharing that, because it is true. I find that if I'm going through people's LinkedIn or Facebook, the ones that I'm the most attracted to, and I'll catch myself involuntarily smiling, are the ones that sound human, and they're mm-hmm. a little snarky. And sometimes they're like admitting they made this huge boo-boo, but there's a funny part to it. Those are the people that I gravitate towards.
Yep. You're not alone. You're not special. Most people Aww. Do. And that tough love.
Okay, this is tough over. Love. I'm done. We talked, you and I had talked, I think, in our pre-interview about the 6 principles of strategic authenticity. And you spelled it out from humans, ... And you said they're good training wheels to help you make tangible action to operating with more authenticity. Let's talk about that. Can you walk through each one of those principles entail?
Yeah. And what I mean by that is, you know, I'm not here to tell you exactly how to act because that would be hypocritical. But also, I think a lot of people get frustrated that they know authenticity is, you know, they know that authenticity is powerful. They read the articles, they nod their head, but then they wake up the next day and they do the same stuff, different day, right? And so humans, the six principles of strategic authenticity are meant to really give you those actions. Like I always say, they're action verbs. They're not adjectives, which I don't even know if that's accurate in, you know, true like English. But what I mean is they're things to do and to get you going. And so the H stands for humility. And what I always say is humility is a speed pass to connection and trust. So this is the concept of purposely, when you introduce yourself, add in something of humility, a humility story. I actually work with clients all the time to craft what we call their intriguing intro. And it has three components to it. One is a humility moment. One is a big brag. And then one is a what's in it for them. So how do you, you know, start out a meeting with the humility? Go to, like, I rarely will you get on a meeting with me or even a podcast. I don't feel comfortable not having a humility sort of moment or story in the first 5 minutes, because the last thing I want is people to think like I'm perfect. Like when you said seamlessly transition, I was like, oh no, I didn't. Right. Like I want you to know I'm not perfect. So that's humility. That's the H. U stands for unexpected. And the authenticos, remember when I mentioned the three words, one of them is original. And people who are authentic don't focus on what's normal. They focus on what's needed. So when I say unexpected, that doesn't mean I'll do something like showy because you're like, look at me. It's really, how do you do the thing that's maybe not normal, but's needed, that's different, that's bold? Like, how do you constantly, and that's really kind of the foundation of my next book, The 50% Rule. How do you at least half do something new, fresh, get rid of what's crusty or doesn't feel like you? And in fact, when I talk to corporate audiences, I'm always like, you know, do you get frustrated? Have you gotten frustrated in the last week where you've had a meeting and people aren't sort of, you know, they're multitasking, they're not listening to you. And they're always like, yeah. And I'm like, yeah, it's your fault. It's your fault. You're way too expected. So using unexpected, both as a strategic way to get people to pay attention, but also to innovate and do things that get you away from, you know, the boring, oh, that's just always how we run a status meeting. And so that's how I do it. Constantly looking at unexpected. M is for model. And really this is, you know, shut up and show up. This is, you know, people who are authentic demonstrate, you know, they know that people listen to words, but they emulate action. And so authentic people are constantly not telling people what to do. Like, oh, make sure you take your vacation time. It's like, well, that's not crap. If that's a bunch of crap, if you didn't take vacation. Instead, as a leader, like, take vacation, check out, make sure people know you did. And so in the book, I talk a lot about moving from a managed mindset to a model mindset and dive deep into that. The A stands for adapt. And so that is two parts. One, you got to plug in to other people. That doesn't mean if you think somebody's stuffy and boring, becoming stuffy and boring. But, you know, authenticity is a, it's a dial, right? And you have to, you know, I would never walk into a room of like really sort of introverted, nervous Nellies and be the same person as I am on stage. Cause that's just not a good way to plug into them. And then it's also adapt is all about, you know, your authenticity changes, who you are changes. And so focus more on who you want to be than sort of who you are. And then the N, two more letters, N is narrate, which is essentially storytelling. And I spent a lot of time with teams. I spent a lot of time in the book talking about what I think is the most underutilized weapon in business, which is storytelling. And I think entrepreneurs probably do this more because we've got story brand and we learn about marketing and emails with stories. But I think we still fall short. The story is always more powerful than data and facts. And so that's a really deep one that I think is powerful that I dive into in the book. And then the last is spark. So humans, the S is spark. And this is essentially when you can understand not only is authenticity not about you, it's about the connection, trust, and intrigue that you create for others. But also that when you do authenticity at a macro level, that you create this sort of flywheel, even if you're not the CEO of the business. And this is really important, because the biggest objection, of course, I always get for people that work and they're not the boss man or the boss woman is, but what if my leadership or our culture or CEO? And it's like, well, no, that's not how it works. First of all, CEOs all think they're authentic. I spoke to like 200 of them up in Canada a couple of months ago, and they were like, yeah, we're authentic. I'm like, no, you're not. You're authentic in your one-on-ones, you're authentic in your team meetings, but you're inauthentic AF when you face out to the public, when you go to your board meetings, when you do the town hall, when you write your emails. And it's mostly not your fault. Part of this is you have all these handlers that start to come in, right? And the corporate comms and the legal people and the board preps with your chief of staff. But so, like, don't even think about the CEOs, because they've got their own work to do. They think they're authentic and they're not. And they're actually the higher level people are the ones our data shows that want authenticity more. So there was some of the interesting data, but you can't sit around and wait for it to come from the top down. Inspirational is a circular reference. And so when you could start to understand the macro effects of your authenticity in your culture, in your team, in your family, that's when it gets really powerful.
I have to ask, Erin, when you were talking with these CEOs and they were insisting that they were authentic and you said, no, you're not. Do you have any great stories that you can share without naming names where somebody said, oh, hang on a second. Okay, let's talk a bit more about this.
Yeah, the one that comes to mind was a couple years ago. It was November, right around Thanksgiving. I was doing a two-part virtual session with the C-suite team of a Fortune 250 company. And we had sort of day one was sort of what I call my authenticity awakening. So this was, you know, really sort of reframing what it is, talking about the data, how do you start doing it? How do you start experimenting? And everybody was super bought in, really engaged. I was like, oh my God, I love it. I love impacting everyone. But you know, when you can get people at the top, like that's great. And then we came back after the Thanksgiving holiday, the US Thanksgiving holiday, and we had our sort of, and then we were sharing, you know, how did they experiment? And this one guy who was probably the most positively vocal in the first session, all of a sudden sort of becomes negative Nelly, you know, the hangover set in. And he's like, well, but here's the thing, Erin, you don't really understand, which I always laugh. It's like, I was in corporate America. Like I ran with the big dogs. I do understand. But he says, we don't often know if our prospects or even our clients want authenticity. And before I could respond, one of his colleagues in another box on the Zoom call, I could see her sort of have this like real-time epiphany. And she's like, wait, I have to tell this story. And so she said, well, last week it was Thanksgiving and I had, it was the Wednesday before I was hosting. So I was cooking, my mom was in town, but there's the CEO that I've been trying to meet with. And she said, and the CEO is very, and she makes like this pursed up face, like, you know, stodgy, stuffy, whatever. And the only time, of course, he had was like Wednesday at 1 o'clock before Thanksgiving. Right. And you're like, ugh. You know, everybody just wants to like sit back and relax and head into the holiday weekend. But so she took the meeting, but her mom was in town and her mom's a former pastry chef. So she was telling us about how her mother was making these new recipes. One had Bailey's in them, one had Kahlua in it. And she put the pies in the oven, but then her mom had to like run to the store or something. And so I was in charge of taking the pies out. She said, but then I realized the pies were sort of due out of the oven at the same exact time I was supposed to jump on this, you know, Zoom call with the CEO. And of course she was like, oh my God, pie CEO. And we're like, you know, we're hanging on edge. We're like, please pick the pies. And so she's like, I pick the pie. But so I slide into my seat and I hit on like 1 minute late, which is giving her anxiety, right? Because this is a big meeting. And because she had no time to really think about it. And also I think there's some magic as we head into what most adults think is the best holiday ever, Thanksgiving, right? She just sort of like blurted out, sorry, I'm late. I had to get my mother's pies out of the oven or whatever. And she said, I came out and all of a sudden the look on his face, that pursed up like face, totally changed. And so he starts asking me about it. And I tell him I'm my mom. And then he tells me a story about his grandmother and the pies. And she said, by the end of the conversation, he was like, when you send me that proposal, you better have a proposal in there. You must better include those pies in there. And she said, totally transformed. Yeah. It totally transformed the conversation.
Yeah.
And it was great because, you know, I didn't have to like give them some theory or even maybe a story. Like they had their own colleague who experienced it firsthand with what seemingly was the most stuffy, inauthentic, you know, prospector, you know, that they were talking to. And it just demonstrates that it doesn't matter, you know, what level you are, what you're looking for. I mean, our data shows that everybody wants it. And people in senior levels actually want it more. People that are older actually want it more. That was, you know, some of our data that was surprising. You think it's just the millennials, individual contributors that are, you know, off to the races and don't give a shit what you think of them. And they just want authenticity. It's like, no, actually our data shows the opposite. But unfortunately, you know, the senior level folks, the older folks have been just so conditioned that that's not something they can have because the workplace, you know.
And they're so protected too. I mean, you can't just go up and say, hey, Harry, how are you doing? You don't do that, I don't think.
You don't think you should, but that's why they have to work harder, right? Uh-huh. And that's what I'm so proud of. You know, I mean, I was CEO. I had about 1,000 people that worked for me. I was a subsidiary company. So, you know, it wasn't this Fortune 250 size. But I could have, I mean, in fact, I'll tell you, I remember the first time they, you know, my corporate comms sort of dotted line person stepped in to write an org change. We had this like company-wide org changes we had to do. We had consultants in for 3 months. We had to analyze and everybody was doing sort of restructuring at the same time. It was brutal. It was miserable, right? And so they had these very coordinated communications that were going out throughout the company this 1 week. And so sure, and you know, I hand it over to him and have him write it. And I remember Denise getting it back. Like, I remember the first thing I did, I put on like editing, right? Knowing I would probably have to redline a few things, make sure, you know, sound. And I put on the redline and I start reading and I'm like, I can't even redline this. I have no idea what he's saying in this thing. Like, I have no idea. And it was all big words and it didn't make sense. And I was just like, you know what? I'm all set. Like, and I did my own communication and I got rid of my stupid picture at the top and I didn't use the template and I wrote like I talk. So my point is when you're at the top, you could say, well, but I've got this person that does it. And it's like, well, it's your job to push and force your authenticity out there because you're actually, yeah, like you said, you're going to fight against it even more because handlers.
Exactly. And we are human. And I don't know. And I've watched this and I was writing down while you were talking. I tend to not hear what people say. I mean, I hear it, but I'm probably not going to retain it because I'm actually watching what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, people can put politicians in particular good at spouting out a whole bunch of garbage in the deep South garbage. But then you watch what they did and you're like, oh, you little bastard. That's not authentic. And once you get that idea of a person, you know, in corporations or in wherever they are in the world, once you kind of get that idea that they're just a nasty person, I don't know how they're going to recover from that in your eyes without saying, you know what, I'm human. I boo-booed.
Yeah. And then if they do that, they can actually skyrocket your trust, right? You know, there are ways to recover, but yeah, no, I love it. I mean, that's why model is one of the principles, because it's about demonstrating. It's about, you know, the classic walk the walk, and that's what people are watching.
They are. And I mean, when you started doing this and you've finally just dove into who you are and what you do and what you bring to the table, were there days where you said, what am I doing? This doesn't work. These people are fighting me every inch of the way. Or was it seamless? I'm going to go ahead and say it. I wrote that down too.
That's so funny. So I would say from a message perspective, because I've done so such a variety. So I've talked to special operations forces in the military that were transitioning in, back into sort of civilian jobs. I've spoken to university students. I've the C-suite. I've spoken to, you know, men, women. I feel like I have a really good sample size. I will tell you, the message itself, the tangibility, is always really well received. I mean, the CEO group was interesting. It was mostly well received, but I did have one of the CEOs like 5 minutes into my talk. I hadn't even like raised his hand, and I was like, okay, we're doing this. We're already talking. Okay, let's hear what you have to say. And he was like, well, this just seems obvious. I mean, that's, you have to be authentic, don't you? So I would say, with the exception of sort of my friend there, it's really well received. I think the hard part, because let's share the struggles, is, you know, selling it sometimes, you know, getting companies to understand, well, what you help, like you help companies use it as a strategic advantage, and sort of getting past, like, it doesn't fit into a box, right? If they've got their training plan for the year, whether that's their leadership or their sales training, like none of what I do probably fits into their already predefined plan. And so that's the biggest struggle. So that's why I said the companies where they, you know, usually it's, you know, some individual gets really bought in. I go in, do a session or two, and then they start to see real tangible effects. And those are my, you know, best clients where they have me come back and I could do sort of real time coaching sessions and, you know, more than just, you know, kind of a keynote or a workshop or two. So that's the biggest struggle is people, they buy into it, but I don't think everybody understands just how powerful what I teach. And the best part about it is that it can help you both with your culture side of things, which you always want to work on, but you never have freaking time or money to do. And it can help you with your sales, business development, your external side. So that's probably the biggest struggle.
And at home. And I wanted to ask you, how do you get brought into these companies? Apparently, I'm guessing, and this is just me spitballing here, that companies, corporations, whoever it is that's saying, come talk with us, they know they have an issue. Maybe they can't articulate what it is, though.
Yeah. I mean, I'd say a couple of ways. I mean, one is through referrals, you know, is obviously huge in this business. And so that's probably 50% where people are like, oh my God, you know, she really helped out our team. The other, you know, is my messaging on LinkedIn. To be honest, I spent a lot of time on LinkedIn trying to, and I don't give a two hoots what anybody thinks of me, including old bosses. And I know a lot of people in a lot of big places. And so I think most people, they finally get like the stuff I talk about is both resonates with them, right? The way I say it, like you said, the snarkiness and the, you know, the sass and whatever, but also starts to really hit home. And usually it's, they've got something, or I mean, I always say to teams, like if I can't help you with one of your top three problems, you shouldn't work with me because I've been in your shoes. Like you only really have room to invest the time and money in your top three sort of opportunities or problems. But when, you know, for example, I'm doing a keynote in a couple of weeks with a big benefit consultant in the group benefit space. And they're like, our biggest goal is to really be seen as a trusted advisor, move from the transactional to creating trust and relationships and strategy. And so it was like a no-brainer. I'm like, authenticity is my word, but I'm really in the business of trust and connection. So that's always how it is. And I actually really force those conversations as somebody who's, you know, really wears a business hat, not a HRE fluffy hat. You know, I always want to know, what are you trying to achieve? Are you trying to, you know, like I have one client who has underwriters that they want to, you know, what they told me is they have to be more salesy. And I'm like, oh my God, you tell that to an underwriter, they're going to throw up or leave, right? Like nobody in that profession ever went in that profession to be told they have to be more salesy. But if you can teach them about the power of authenticity and how to interact more authentically with clients, with their colleagues, like then you're going to get the same results. It's just going to feel a lot less icky. So you're absolutely right. We always talk about what are you trying to do? And I don't BS people. Like if they're, if they're just like, oh, we really want to get our sales people to be more machines and produce more. I'm like, that's probably a million other people that are much better at that.
Yeah, it's not going to happen. Yeah. Listen, as humans, we know, most of us know when we're being sold and we don't like it.
No.
At all. My spidey sense just goes through the roof and I'm like, gotta go.
Yeah.
Now, if you want to have a conversation with me and I can pick something out about you that I like or find attractive or funny or snarky, then we can continue the conversation. But if you're just going to jump into a sales pitch, you're going to hear a click.
That's yeah. It.
I don't even say goodbye. I'm gone.
Yep.
And that's, you know, that's devastating for the poor schmuck on the other end of the phone. I don't care. You were trained wrong. Go back.
Get some
better training. You've mentioned a couple of times, you've got a new book coming, The 50% Rule.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that. And let me ask you, will you come back when that book is ready and come back on the show?
Of course, I would be happy to. Yeah, I am. Honestly, I'm obsessed with this book. Like, it's weird. And I'm obsessed both with the concept because I've been using it for so long and have others used it. And so, the concept itself is not new. So I'm super obsessed with the concept, but I love this book too. It's just, it's You Do You-ish on steroids. It's snarky and funny, but it's got stories of mine, but it's got a lot of other stories. So the quick, what is it? The 50% rule is very simple and it's on the surface. And it essentially says anytime you're learning something new, listening to a podcast, getting advice, starting a new venture, doing something hard, only take about 50% of what people are telling you or what the playbook is today, and then throw out the 50% that feels icky or feels like it probably doesn't work or it's old or you just don't want to do it. And then bring in, curate your own 50% new ideas, merge it with other ideas. And so that alone, of course, is not enough to write, 55,000 words about it. What happened is I was using that for myself because as a new entrepreneur, I got stuck in the you know this, right? Here's the formula. Here's the playbook. And then all of a sudden I was like freaking miserable and not doing things right. And I sort of one day was like, well, what if you 50% rule it? And then I started, other people would come to me and it was very organic. Like they'd be like, oh, I'm having trouble with this. And I'm like, what if you just 50% rule it? And they're like, huh? And so that, caught on. And then what happened is I started to see it everywhere. So the book is a little, if I could be so bold, it's like a cross between like a Jen Sincero tough love, but and a Malcolm Gladwell, like I see things that people don't, patterns that other people don't necessarily see. And so I started to see the 50% rule in people like Weird Al Yankovic and Hamilton, John Madden, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Savannah Bananas. I started to see all of these people that had this great success, not necessarily because they were the most talented or gutted it out and worked the hardest, but because they took 50% sort of normal and 50% of new and smashed it together. And so the book has a lot of different stories. There's over 60 quotes, kind of like in You Do You-ish. I think my favorite one, I don't have those memorized, but is I think the 50% rule is like putting matchmaking your two best friends and letting them make whoopee. So it's like all these anecdotes and different things that help you use the 50% rule, not just to get over your shit, but actually to leapfrog others, to kind of go from underdog to unmatched using the rule.
Okay. Now I have to ask, this is probably a two-part question. Who are some of the highly successful people or companies that have exemplify using the 50% rule? And my next question is going to be, how did you do it? What are some notable moments in your career where you went, aha?
So many. I use it now, like everything. But so an example, the GOAT that I said is the 50% rule GOAT is Hamilton. So if you think about the Broadway show Hamilton, this is, first of all, not the first time Hamilton was a Broadway show. It was a Broadway show back in the 30s, and it only ran for like, 3 or 4 months. It's also not the first time that Lin-Manuel Miranda used hip hop in a Broadway show. So he actually, his first show is called In the Heights, and it's about a modern day Latinx sort of community, and he uses hip hop. But the thing with that is it's sort of expected. And so what the power and one of the lessons from Hamilton is that juxtapositions create joyful jolts. And what I mean by that is he took something totally, like, he took half normal, right? He has the Broadway set and he has the, you know, the actors and the dancing, but he put hip hop and music with white dudes who wrote with feather pens from 300 years ago, right? And so, yes, there is brilliance in his songwriting, all of this, but the reason it's such a mega hit is because he 50% ruled it. So that's what I mean by the stories. That, you know, Weird Al Yankovic is another example, somebody that 50% ruled music. For me, so I use it constantly. Like, it's running in my head. The big one that I'm most excited about is actually the book tour. So while I was writing the book, I was having fun, but I was instantaneously dreading the launch, like most authors do, because we have to market the crap out of this. And what do we have to do? We think we have to follow the playbook and we have to put together a huge project plan and we have to execute. And then I wrote half of one chapter and I went up and I was in the shower and I was like, well, why don't you take your own medicine? What if you 50% rule it? And so I started to think about book tours and how I just hate how they're like boring and you've got to go to like a coffee shop or a bookstore. And then I, you know, part of what I suggest in the chapters, think about things that you like to do. And so I was like, well, I'm pretty laid back. Like, I like a good IPA beer and a lawn chair and a tailgate with a cornhole and hanging out with friends. And then I was like, why not make this a tailgate book tour? So just that one little change. So the whole, we call it it's called the half ridiculously authentic, half rampantly something. I can't even remember the name of it. Authentic book tailgate tour. And we're having fun with it. And we're doing one with UConn at a brewery and they're totally on board, at university, obviously here in Connecticut. We're doing one at a jewelry store. We're going to even make like bleachers and stuff. And so it's just so much more fun. And honestly, Denise, it's like the tiniest switch, right? I just literally, I'll go to people and they're like, oh, we'd love to do like a book club. And I was like, that's great. It just has to be tailgate theme. And they're like, oh, that's amazing. And I'm like, you know, it's not rocket science, but everybody is so craving, right? Something slightly different, something slightly new. And when you 50% rule it, that's what you do. And it just makes it just a heck of a lot more fun for you and for others. So that's just one example. But even while I was writing the book, I mean, part of my snarky in the book is like, you might think this rule is simple and you might just stop reading, whatever. But even while I was writing the book, I was not 50% ruling stuff I should 50% rule, like my health and my back. And so I tell stories about, even as like the 50% rule queen, I keep missing it. And so that's why I'm excited about the book, because I think once you go through it, one, it's not horrible. It's super, super fun to read, but there's no way you can't walk through life just like basically 50% ruling everything after you read it. So yeah, thanks for asking. I absolutely love this darn thing. I can't wait for it to come out in October and I'd love to come back.
I can't wait for it to land on my desk. You know, we've talked about Thanksgiving. We're talking about, you know, your IPA and, you know, the way you're going to be doing your book tour, so to speak. I'm snarky. You're snarky. We have fun together. I live in the deep south. Yeah, I'm 15 miles from the Gulf of Mexico. It's a crow fly. So, you know, we do things a little bit differently here in this part of the world. And it's not unusual to, you know, have somebody call and say, Denise, we're having a high tea. Would you like to come? No. But I'll tell you why. Because you can come to my house and we'll do a low tea. We'll do baseball caps, hot dogs.
Yep. And they're
we can do a low tea. And I've had people go, oh my God, that sounds like more fun than putting on gloves and a fluffy hat and a flowered dress. Who even owns a flowered dress these days?
So I love it. See, you're a 50% ruler already. I love
it. There you go. Well, listen, this has been an amazing conversation. And thank you for the book. And thank you for coming on the show. Before I let you go, is there anything you want the audience to know? And where can they find you?
Yeah. I mean, the one thing I say to know is like, just experiment. So you're going to take all this in and then you're like, oh, it's amazing. Oh my God. And then you're going to wake up and be like, okay, what do I do? Just experiment with authenticity, change up, you know, my people's favorite experimentation is changing their out of office, to be you know, a little more human. Some make it fun. Some just actually tell the truth and don't sound like a robot. Change up how you send an email, just one line in it. Use humility at the beginning of a meeting that you normally wouldn't. And just experiment, because what will happen is if you experiment and then also observe, so collect data, little data, right? Did that stuffy CEO smile that normally doesn't? Did that person respond faster than they did? I make a sale? Like, eventually, like, you're not going to need my framework. It's always helpful, but you're just going to be addicted to new way of being. And that's essentially what happened to me. And that's what I'm trying to have happen for other people. So yeah, the best way to find me, I mean, you're already listening to podcasts. Once you consume all of these podcasts, then I have a podcast called Because Work Doesn't Have to Suck. It's just the letter B and then C-A-U-S-E, Work Doesn't Have to Suck. So that's a lot of snarkiness. I co-host it with my crazy friend who's Mensa level smart and also a complete and utter idiot. So it's really fun.
I haven't listened yet, but it is on my list of things to do later this afternoon. I'll let you know. If I'm laughing too hard, I'll have to type you something, but
You'll have to about 50% of the episodes are Nicole and I, the other 50% are sort of interviews or solo episodes. So I like anything with podcasts, pick out the ones that speak to you, right? The titles that speak to you. And then LinkedIn, if you want to interact in a more human way, I'm a loser. I'm on LinkedIn all the time. So if you can spell my name, you can find me there. I'd love to stay connected there as well.
And where can people find your book?
Amazon's probably the best. You Do You-ish. I have it on my website too, but we sell it on Amazon. It's on all the bookstores. It's anywhere you find books online, mostly. You Do You-ish.
I'm going to have to pick all my little sticky notes out of here. And well, some of them have to stay because my audience knows this. They're different colors. Different colors mean different things. And, you know, if it's a pink one, that probably means I really need to go back and reread this. If it's a green one, that's a money shot right there. she gave me some money information. But the books get a little bit too fat, so I'm going to have to clean it out a little bit. Then it's going to go on my bookshelves. I've got three of them, and every book in this room, and I thank all of my guests, every single book in this room was gifted by people like you, my podcast guests. So thank you, Erin. Listen, thank you so much. And to our audience, be sure to, let me back up a bit. As we conclude today's episode, your feedback means a lot to me. And if you found the show helpful, please support us with a quick review on iTunes. Your input is vital in my mission to inspire and empower more individuals. So don't forget to hit subscribe, leave a review, and share your part in Success Radio with friends and colleagues. And be sure to go find Erin Hatzacostas. Did I say that right that time?
You nailed it.
All right. On the web and connect with her and get this book. It is amazing. It is funny. It is smart. It is witty. Get it. You will thank her for it. So thank you for tuning in. And I will see you next week. Erin, again, thank you so much. And I'll see you the next time.
Thank you, Denise.
Get your voice heard. If you would like to launch your own far-reaching podcast, contact Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com and go to the podcast tab.